We can start from the question, why did Putin start the war? And that's probably the most urgent question that many people are asking right now and don't find actually a very good answer to it. And many people say that they continue, that basically they repeat Putin, something about NATO or security threats to Russia and so on and so forth, as if the security of Putin's regime is just the same as the national security of the Russian society. And on the other hand, many people seriously think that Putin is just mad. He's an ideological zealot, fanatic, bigot, and he just hates Ukrainians. And so that's the whole war is about just some pure fantasy capturing his mind and throwing the whole country and actually like almost the whole world into some kind of like disaster that we are experiencing now and also experience in Germany. I actually believe that what Putin does is in the rational collective interests of the Russian ruling class. He protects what the Russian ruling class needs in the long-standing class conflict in the post-Soviet societies. It's actually much more than about Russia and Ukraine. It's about the whole region. But in order to understand why is it is so, or at least why I believe it is so, it requires quite a long lecture on what was happening in the whole post-Soviet space and why it has actually been a permanent crisis, and why this crisis led to the culmination in the full-scale war that is going on now in Ukraine, and why this war could actually be the end of this crisis. So, and why Gramsci is actually very much relevant about it, to this, of course. So I'm going to speak about what is post-Soviet condition. I'm going to speak also about how most people who try to apply Gramsci to the post-Soviet societies, they try to approach the problems with the concept of passive revolutions, which I believe is completely misleading in our countries. And what it's better to understand the post-Soviet societies is actually another Gramscian concept, hegemony crisis. And what we've seen in the post-Soviet societies have been two deficient solutions to the hegemony crisis, which were not able to solve the crisis. They were either simply conserving the crisis, Caesarist solution, or reproducing and intensifying the crisis via the deficient so-called Maidan revolutions. And understanding this vicious circle of Caesarism and Maidan revolutions, of two deficient solutions, we could understand better the class conflict which stands behind the war in Ukraine and why it could be an end to the very long-standing and very deep crisis of the post-Soviet conditions, the crisis of hegemony. So, post-Soviet condition. In the 90s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, many people believed that would be a road to democracy, that Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, even Central Asia, Caucasian countries, they would follow the road of the Central Europe. They would be democratizing like Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, as they were actually democratizing, liberalizing in 1990s. Then 2010 years came, and that sounded like very much a fairy tale, because it was not like kind of like democratic convergence with the Central Europe. It started to look like Orbán's Hungary and Kaczynski's Poland were moving towards Putin's Russia and Lukashenko's Belarus. So it was looking like not a democratic consolidation, but an authoritarian consolidation. And in this perspective, Ukraine was just kind of like about a weaker authoritarian regime where no candidate to strong authoritarian rule, no Ukrainian president was capable to consolidate the power and to build a kind of like a Putinist regime, but in Ukraine. So other people started to say that just let's say goodbye to the post-Soviet concept. All those countries between, on the one hand, Baltic states, which are EU member states, let's put the most extreme case, Estonia, which believes itself to be a kind of like almost a Nordic country now. And on the other hand, let's say Tajikistan in Central Asia, they just became too divergent. And there is no even sense to speak about any post-Soviet commonality between them. So farewell to the post-Soviet concept. Another response to this could be that actually the very fact that we cannot define in any positive terms what is post-Soviet, besides saying that this is something that followed the Soviet, is actually an answer to the question. Post-Soviet has been a continuous permanent crisis when nothing new replaced the old dying Soviet structures. And that already sounds very, very much Gramscian. The moment when the old has died, but the new has not have born. Many people, however, who tried to speak about Gramsci in post-Soviet context, they were speaking about a passive revolution. Like Gramsci, I know probably there have been already many discussions about the passive revolution. That's a central concept for Gramsci. And originally, he talked about why Italy was not able to follow the route of the French Revolution, a revolution under strong bourgeois hegemony. Why Italy was united by the Piemontese kingdom from above, but the initiatives of Mazzini, Garibaldi failed. And so the passive revolution concept existed in relation to the Jacobin revolution. Italy didn't have a proper Jacobin revolution under bourgeois hegemony, so it had to modernize, it had to build a bourgeois order, it had to build the modern nation state from above via different route. And unfortunately, that original use has been kind of like forgotten. And that's also partially Gramscian fault when he started to discuss fascism as a passive revolution, American Fordism as a passive revolution. And there were some arguments behind this because it could look like as some other modernizing changes made by the ruling class under the new conditions, but under the conditions of the threat from a Bolshevik, from the Russian Revolution. And that's why New Deal in the United States, and that's why transformation of the Italian state by fascists. But since then, the people talked about neoliberal passive revolution, some decolonization passive revolution, the Mexican Revolution as a passive revolution. And of course, in the context of the Soviet and post-Soviet societies, Stalinist passive revolution, Gorbachev passive revolution, Putin's passive revolution. And you now feel that this concept becomes like just too inflated. You can basically interpret every changes that are beneficial to the capitalism, but which are not done under the revolutionary bourgeois hegemony as a passive revolution and make some sense. And of course, Gramscian very, quite obscure writings are very much easy to exploit in this direction. So if you want to make any actual use to understand, to explain, and to change the world, we need stricter concepts. And if you stick to the original use in Gramsci, The passive revolution will be conservative modernization by or in compromise with the old ruling class that incorporates some of the grievances of the subaltern classes in the context, and this is crucial, of a threat of a Jacobin social revolution and in order to prevent one. So the Italian ruling class in the 19th century, they were feeling the threat of the Jacobin revolution that happened in France and was actually very much of a threat in the whole Europe during the 19th century. 1848 was about that, of course. But they were capable to push forward the objectively progressive changes, but from the above, without challenging the rule of the old ruling class. So now if you look at the Soviet and post-Soviet conditions, we would see some superficial similarities with this, and well, that's why many people are speaking about post-Soviet passive revolution. So, of course, the Soviet elite, so-called nomenklatura, the top of the Communist Party, they were playing a very important agency in the capitalist transformation of the former Soviet Union. They were, in the process, they were turning themselves and helping to turn other people into the new capitalists. But this was a very specific kind of capitalist whose income fundamentally dependent on the relations to the state. They were political capitalists. They could exploit connections to the political offices, to the specific people, to the specific parties in order to make themselves rich. And on the other hand, the oppositional intelligentsia in the Soviet Union were very much like those Italian Jacobins about whom Gramsci actually wrote very despisingly. He despised them. So he saw that those Italian Jacobins were trying to use the experience of France without any serious application to the difference of the Italian context. And that's why they were failing. And we could see very many similarities with how the Soviet oppositional intelligentsia, the dissidents, and then the post-Soviet professional middle class, so this vibrant civil society, is caught into this illusion that we need to join proper capitalism, not like our bad post-Soviet capitalism with oligarchs, with Putins, and so on and so forth, but the proper capitalism of the EU, of the United States, and actually join the so-called civilized world, join the elite. And if you are in this very clearly elitist project, that helps to understand why they are remaining not so much popular and why they were failing to form a proper hegemony in the post-Soviet countries. But there are fundamental differences, and that's important to understand the basis of the crisis, and it's also important to understand why passive revolution is quite a misleading concept, to understand what happens. Post-Soviet transformation have never been modernization. We were not transforming into a more progressive social order, state institutions, economic institutions. This was primarily about demodernizations, about so-called involution, not evolution, but involution, peripherization of our economies from the economies that were capable to lead in the space race, that were capable to lead in many social achievements of the Soviet age, and that's why the Soviet Union, until some moment, 70s, 80s, was actually presenting a progressive alternative to many third world countries. And many revolutionary movements where they were actually trying to copy the Soviet experience. And there was a reason for that. The post-Soviet transformation was very much a rejection of everything. that happened, and not in favor of anything more progressive. Fundamentally, the second difference, there was no actual a threat of a Jacobin, neo-Jacobin, of any social revolution. We are now actually living in the world where we do not have social revolutions anymore. We do have many revolutions, but they do not challenge the ruling classes. And I'll be speaking about that a little bit later, about the so-called Maidan revolutions. And this is the problem that actually many sociologists, many social scientists and on the left, on in the mainstream, they raise this question. Where did the social revolutions go? Why we have some kind of revolutionary change of the government in many cases every year, but nothing is changing? And if you do not have a threat from a Jacobin revolution, we cannot have a passive revolution. There is just no need to push for some progressive changes from above. And some people just are confused about things like return of the Soviet anthem by Putin that he made in the 2000s, or some restoration of the social benefits. But this is a typical Caesarist balancing. There is nothing actually progressive in just making the old Soviet institutions work. And finally, those intellectuals, quasi-Jacobin, post-Soviet Jacobins, they were not actually allied with the plebeian masses like in the 19th century Italy. They were opposed to them. They were despising them. They saw them as some backward Soviet rigid people who just vote for Putin and who are actually a part of the problem why we cannot join the proper capitalism of the civilized world. And so that's why there was no anything like transformismo, the individual take of the leaders of the subaltern classes and integration them into the elite. For the post-Soviet rulers, it was better to actually to emphasize this gap between the middle-class opposition on the one hand and regular people who are in favor of Putin or Lukashenko. So that's why this is not a passive revolution, and just too many fundamental differences from what Gramsci was talking about. However, Gramsci is actually useful with the concept of hegemony crisis. And of course, I believe you've been talking about like 5 days about this, and probably this was the most used and misused and abused concept. And yeah, Perry Anderson just recently published a book, H-Word, because just so many people use it in so many different meanings, and just not even pretending to give like a proper understanding of what is hegemony, but to point to the most substantive Gramscian fragments in the Prison Notebooks, where he analyzes hegemony in the context of the specifically political development of social classes in the degree of their homogeneity and self-consciousness. So political organization of the social classes and also the consciousness development of the social classes. So first, he starts from the so-called economic corporate stage when merchants are organized and think about merchant interests, and industrialists are thinking about industrialists' interests, and these fractions of ruling class or subaltern classes are organized and mobilized just at themselves, economic corporate stage, thinking primarily about the purely economic interests. But then the class consciousness stage, when the understanding of the interest of the whole class of bourgeoisie or proletariat develops, and one fraction of that class is capable to present their particular interests at the interest of the whole class. And then the final stage is actually hegemony, the political, intellectual, and moral leadership of one class over the others. So when the interests of certain fraction of the class, certain group within the class, could be presented as the interest of the whole class, but also as the interest of other classes, and in extreme, as the national interests. And fundamentally, this is not just about claim. Yeah, I'm speaking on behalf of the whole nation. But this is also the capacity to at least partially fulfill the interests of other groups and classes. And therefore, that's this difference between coercion and consent. The hegemonic class is capable to mobilize the rational, active, participatory consent with its leadership. And these are all very important concepts. Because hegemony is not just irrational manipulation, it's actually a rational understanding of the intersection of our interests. It's active consent. It's not simply passive consent because I support Putin, because if not Putin, who else? It's an active consent. It's an enthusiastic consent. And it's participation. And that's why hegemony requires specific institutions, like political parties, civil society institutions, press, clubs, civil society organizations, which mobilize an active participatory consent with the rule of some class. But in the post-Soviet societies, we had rather hegemony crisis. Fundamentally, hegemony crisis is the crisis of political representation, where there is the break between the interest of the specific social groups and their political representatives. If hegemony is about leadership, hegemony crisis is that when we just stop believe those people who claim to be our leaders. Crisis is a long process. It's not necessarily an event, and Gramsci has very much discussed distinction between organic crisis and conjunctural crisis. Conjunctural, something short, occasional, accidental, but organic crisis is a permanent crisis. And in this understanding, the organic crisis may last for years, decades, even centuries. Gramsci wrote about the medieval hegemony crisis. And the source of the hegemony crisis could be, for example, the failure of the ruling class in some major undertaking, or a quantitative accumulation of unrest from below. And there could be organic and apparently inorganic deficient solutions to the crisis of hegemony. Organic solutions would be when one party fails in hegemony, but another party can immediately take over the hegemony. But when it doesn't happen, we enter the hegemony crisis. And this is precisely what happened in the Soviet Union, let's say in the end of the 1960s. We did have communist hegemony. So, of course, Gramsci understood the Bolshevik Revolution as the war of maneuver, where Bolsheviks came to power quickly because of the weakness of the Russian Empire, basically because of its collapse. But when they came to power, they were very much concerned that they need to expand their rule. They need to involve the majority of the Russian societies, primarily peasants, into the new state. And so they did use vast terror, but at the same time, they did mobilize active, participatory, rational consent with the rule of the new Soviet state. Via the construction of multiple hegemony institutions, the Communist Party was, of course, the most important of them, and it was the center of the new hegemony. But it was not just about the party, it was about the multiple organizations organizing the labor, women, the young people, the expansion of the press, expansion of the political discussion. The people in the Soviet Union were not just scared, they were actually very much politicized. But, and the success of this communist hegemony was actually the most evident during the years of de-Stalinization, during the so-called thaw period, Khrushchev rule, which actually saw the massive activization of the Soviet citizens who were criticizing the Soviet state, but they were criticizing it for not fulfilling the socialist ideals. That's where the concept of the socialism with a human face comes from. So they were so taken by the communist hegemony that they were criticizing the Communist Party for not being proper communists, for failing in the communist project. And that actually it's an evidence of the strength of communist hegemony, not its weakness. But that activization in the 1960s was not incorporated in the Communist Party, and the result was the start of the hegemony crisis, when the majority of the Soviet citizens started to see the Soviet state as completely alien from them, alien to their interests, and not presenting any any leadership, any progressive changes in our country. And this is the start of the hegemony crisis, which we have been actually until this moment. This crisis started about at the end of 1960s, the beginning of the 1970s. 1968 could be kind of like a very symbolic date for the start of this crisis. And the crisis was not limited simply to the Soviet Union. We could speak about the hegemony crisis in the Europe, in the Northern America, but this omnipresent discussion of the crisis of political representation, why people do not vote, why people vote for some populist parties, why they do not believe in the mainstream parties, and so on and so forth. So there is something universal in this condition, but in the Soviet Union, the depth of the hegemony crisis was probably the strongest in the whole world. And there are several reasons for this. First, the post-Soviet ruling class of political capitalists severely lacked legitimacy. They were, from the very start, perceived as thieves, as mafia, as bandits who captured the collapsing Soviet states and who exploited it, who exploited the those property, those achievements that were the result of the mobilization of the whole Soviet people for their private enrichment. There was no ideological, no religious, no traditional legitimation for their rule, unlike in the core capitalist countries. They became rich in the matter of months, almost years. That primitive accumulation that happened in Europe during centuries. And that was happening in basically in our eyes. There was, of course, very limited opportunities for hegemony under the demodernization changes, where everything is contracting and the pie cannot be divided in good pieces. There was, because of the lack of any social revolutionary threat, there was even lack of motivation to lead, not simply to dominate. And leadership, of course, requires more from the ruling class. Hegemony is more demanding kind of rule than the lack of hegemony. And finally, this political representation relationship was undermined both from above and also from below. From above, the new political parties in the post-Soviet countries, they were reproducing and even exacerbating some of the worst features of the late Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Meaningless ideology, which nobody believed in. The careerism, opportunism, the basically lack of any belief that a party is actually the unity of the like-minded people, but not some tool to be exploited for some private interests. That's actually the problem between economic, corporate stage and more like politically developed stage. The parties were not pushing the political development of the ruling class, but they were rather seen as the representatives of very specific, very particular interests. But on the other hand, even the economic corporate consciousness was weak. And for Gramsci, it was not problematized, although when we speak about the interests of merchants, miners, peasants, it's already the interest of some quite broad group, broader than informal patronage networks, ethnic groups, families, and so on. But in the Soviet Union, this representation of the corporate interests were repressed. They were important, but they were moved to the informal sphere. And when the structure of the communist hegemony degraded, rotted, and basically collapsed, what remained? These informal networks. And instead of the interests of at least some socially bounded groups, we've got the informally patronage structured society. When people could, in very contradictory way, combine a huge criticism towards the elite, thieves and mafia, but on the other hand, instead of mobilizing collectively in defense of their interests, they were relying on the same informal patronage channels in order to solve their problems. This is kind of like the bifurcated Philistine consciousness, which was very much predominant in our countries. So if you have hegemony crisis, what are the solutions to this? Did we have any organic solution? In fact, what we did have were the two deficient solutions. One could be described with Gramscian concept of Caesarism, the personalistic authoritarian rule which consolidated in the most of the post-Soviet countries, Russia, Belarus, Azerbaijan, and most of the Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, so on. In Gramsci, Caesarism is a particular solution for the situation which is characterized by the equilibrium of forces heading towards catastrophe. And Caesarism is defensive restorative. It's coercion and also only passive consent of the masses. Nothing like active, enthusiastic, hegemonic support. The masses simply prefer the stability to the risk of the catastrophic changes. And Gramsci has a discussion of the pre-modern and modern Caesarism types, how the Caesarist leaders who relied on military Napoleon Bonaparte. That kind of rule transforms into the police, and from the personalistic leadership to the institutions. He even discussed whether it's possible to have a Caesarist party, and fascist could be discussed as a kind of like a Caesarist collective rule. And that the conflict of those forces which head towards catastrophe becomes an irreconcilable class conflict, which just cannot be solved based on some win-win resolution. In the post-Soviet countries, what we've got, the leaders like Putin or Lukashenko, they are indeed, their major legitimating narrative was that they prevented and overcome the post-Soviet collapse. They restored some stability. And this narrative was the main legitimating tool in order to support their rule. Why people vote for Putin? Primarily because they do not see any other alternative. But it was not just some stability. These kind of leaders, they tamed the centrifugal tendencies in the post-Soviet ruling class during the 1990s collapse. They consolidated it to some extent. They balanced some fractions. They repressed other fractions. So they played some function for consolidating the ruling class, however, not in a hegemonic way. However, there were also some clear specifics. So the situation was not really the symmetrical strength of the fighting social forces that lead to the disaster, but their symmetrical weakness. The weakness both of the ruling class, but also of the subaltern classes. The main post-Soviet conflict is arguably reconcilable between the quasi-Jacobin professional middle classes allied with some oppositional fractions of the ruling class against the Caesarist leaders. And in case of the post-Soviet revolutions, what we've seen is the swapping of the fraction of the ruling class in power, not any existential challenge to the ruling class. And also, the unlike in Gramsci, from pre-modern to modern Caesarism, we actually did have a reverse situation or process, primitivization and personalization of politics. The politics based primarily on the informal patronage networks that were only in kind of like in a facade way represented in the quasi-liberal institutions, in the political parties. So the outcome was not the solution for the hegemony crisis, but its conservation, preservation. The Caesarist solution was fundamentally unstable. One of the sources of the instability is that the personalistic authoritarian rule is open to the crisis of succession. When Putin becomes too old, or Lukashenko is elected as a president for fourth, fifth, sixth time, the people are just tired. And there is a question who would succeed Lukashenko and Putin. And this question is actually a very difficult one because you cannot be wrong about this person. You want to resign in a proper time and you do not want to be removed by your chosen successor. At the same time, so the successor should not be too smart, but at the same time, it should not be too dumb. And the succession crisis is always creating some centrifugal tendencies in the ruling elite when the conflicts between different factions accelerate. And they're thinking now who would win after the old leader is going away. Another deficient solution is a deficient revolution. And here we are with my colleague and co-author, Russian sociologist Oleg Zhuravlev, we are developing a theory of Maidan revolutions. Maidan has actually become a generic concept in Ukraine, but also in the whole post-Soviet space. And I think we can develop it as a generic concept for many countries that would address this fundamental problem of the disappearance of social revolutions nowadays. And this problem is discussed by many authors, and some explain it with the expansion of democracy. It's just doesn't make sense to make a revolution against democracy, or with the expansion of the urbanized societies. We believe that we actually can address this question with the concept of hegemony and counter-hegemony, and understanding how these deficient revolutions, instead of producing the strong hegemony of the new progressive class, they only reproduce and intensify the crisis of hegemony. So the Maidan revolutions, they are characterized by large-scale popular mobilization against the government that combines the revolutionary aspirations, rhetoric, even repertoire of collective actions, violent and nonviolent, with only vaguely articulated claims, with only loose structures of mobilization, with only weak and dispersed leadership. Their counter-hegemony, the revolutionary counter-hegemony, is extremely weak. And that explains why they are so deficient. So they do generate a kind of like revolutionary legitimacy for which political agents may compete and which they can hijack. However, they do not establish a hegemonic relation. And the Maidan revolutions, they respond to the crisis of hegemony. They're fundamentally because of the crisis of political representation that the authoritarian personalistic leaders, they do not represent the societies. However, in the dynamics of these revolutions, they only reproduce the hegemony crisis and even intensify it. And what, for example, happened during the Euromaidan revolution in Ukraine in 2014, how it worked with reproduction and intensification of hegemony crisis, you get like millions of very diverse population at the streets, and they start feeling to be united, representing the whole nation. What happens is a kind of like eventful nationalism connected to very specific mobilization event. And it looks like the universalization of the interests, speaking about presenting the interest as the interest of the whole nation. But in fact, this is kind of like a reverse process to hegemony. The supporters of the revolution, they claim that we do represent the whole united Ukraine. However, the reality is that they are just a part of the society. And those who are not united, who didn't join this unity, became excluded from the nation. And as a result, this Maidan revolution only legitimates both social, and in Ukrainian case, it was also kind of like ethnic othering of the, specifically of the people in the eastern regions, for example. And that's all, of course, also the part of the how the developments to the war unfolded. Then, about the social part of the political representation relation, the Maidan revolutions, they do not universalize the interests of specific social groups that would be seen now as the interest of a class or the whole nation in extreme. But they only empower the middle-class civil societies, which in the post-Soviet case is actually very narrow and form not more than 20% of the population, but in fact even less. And they empower their unpopular agendas. In Ukrainian case, connected to the neoliberal reforms and to the quite divisive nationalist project. And finally, reproduction of hegemony crisis from above. The people believe that their participation in the revolution represents a kind of like authentic politics, fundamentally different from that dirty politics of the elite that they started to protest against. And people fundamentally deny the very political representation. In their minds, it's after the revolution, if anything goes bad against their expectations, they're not going to go to power, to form the political parties, to participate in the political institutions. They would rather make another revolution against another leader who would fail to fulfill their anticipations. And as a result, this revolution only gives a legitimacy, say in Ukrainian case, to another oligarch, Petro Poroshenko, who wins the elections. However, he does not represent the interest of all those diverse people who came to protest at the Maidan Square in Kyiv. They legitimate only another fraction of the same old politicians who exploit the revolutionary legitimacy to push forward the agenda that does not represent the revolutionaries, not speaking about the majority of the society. And in this way, it only reproduces and even intensifies the very crisis that the revolution was supposed to resolve. And this, the post-Euromaidan Ukrainian leaders got into the trap between inflated revolutionary expectations about some fundamental changes. And on the other hand, the unpopular agendas of specific political agents who were capable to hijack the revolution. Some other oligarchic clans, the neoliberal NGOized civil society, the radical nationalists, and also the Western powers, who became much more stronger in Ukraine. And this is why the Maidan revolutions happen so frequently and may even accelerate, because of the reproduction and intensification of the hegemony crisis. And now we come to the war. So this conservative Caesarist and kind of revolutionary solutions form basically a vicious circle. You try to consolidate the Caesarist regime. If you fail, you end in a deficient revolution. Deficient revolution is not capable to establish a proper hegemony, and it only opens the space to hijack the legitimacy and to attempt to establish the new personalistic authoritarian regime that would meet the same problems. So this is kind of like vicious circle. And the question, of course, was, would it be possible to circulate in this way forever? And if not forever, for how long? And it looks like that we've gotten to the culmination of this crisis. It intensified until the terminal point. And that's why the war. So the class conflict behind the war is fundamentally the same. So that conflict, which is resolved now by tanks, rockets, artillery in Ukraine, has been resolved, is police batons in Russia and Belarus. In Russia and Belarus, they were capable to basically to beat people, to suppress their pricings. In Ukraine, there was this circulating revolutions, three in the, during the life of just one generation. And now the same social class is solving with even more escalated violence the same class conflict. And so that's why it's not just about imperialism, not just about Russian imperialism against Ukraine, not just about Western imperialism, however we understand it. It's a class conflict behind it. And the intermixing of the domestic class conflict, but also with the incorporation of the transnational capital with which this quasi Jacobin middle class professionals are allied. And in this conflict, Putin protects the collective rational interests of the Russian ruling class of political capitalists, who would fail as a class in case of the Russian defeat. And we could understand the development of the war, or at least the processes that led to the war, via discussion of the hegemony crisis on multiple levels, not simply on the level of post-Soviet countries, but we could start from the global level. There is a crisis of the United States hegemony, which provides an opportunity for the Russian ruling class to improve their positions in the hierarchy of the global elites. The people are tired from the United States, and especially they are tired about them in the global South. There have been a series of very significant defeats of the US in Afghanistan, the Trump rule. We can name many, many events which led to this. And this is an opportunity for the Russian political capitalists to improve their relative position, to mark the territory where they can claim the monopoly sovereign rule. On the regional level, on the level of the post-Soviet space, it's more about resources. If you cannot claim a kind of like a soft power, hegemony is also like, a soft power is a part of hegemony. When you are not capable to present an attractive vision of Russia to the peripheral post-Soviet elites, what is left for you is coercion. And in some cases, police is enough. In case of Ukraine, they need to use much heavier violence. And on the domestic level, it's a threat. Yes, Maidan revolutions, they were not challenging the ruling class per se. However, they weakened the state that became vulnerable to the pressure from the powerful enemies of the post-Soviet political capitalists, both directly and indirectly. In Ukrainian case, directly from the Western powers representing the transnational capitalist class, and indirectly by from the from their soft power institutionalized in the NGOized civil society. Both of them, they are united in the so-called anti-corruption agenda. And if you think about what is anti-corruption, what is transparency, this is the fundamental threat to the major competitive advantage of the post-Soviet political capitalists. The revolution itself is not a threat, but it undermines the state which makes the ruling class more vulnerable. And so this threat is resolved in the war. So what is going forward? At stake now is the existence of a sovereign center of capital accumulation in the post-Soviet region. One scenario of the development of this culmination of hegemony crisis is basically the post-Soviet disintegration, when we would really say farewell to the post-Soviet region, just goodbye. There would be indeed nothing in common between the different parts of the former Soviet Union, and the elites and also the masses would realign themselves to the politics of the EU, of the US, of China in Central Asia, and in some extreme scenarios we can speak about so-called decolonization of Russia. That's what is actually seriously is discussed as one of the goals to disintegrate this, to finish that process that started in 1917 with the disintegration of the Russian Empire, continued in 1991 with the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and may end in 2020s with the disintegration of the Russian Federation. Or in the process of the war, the Russian ruling class would be capable to move to a higher stage of its political and ideological organization. It could become more hegemonic. It could become more powerful, consolidated, and capable to mobilize more stable, active support, at least from a significant part of the Russian society. What happens now is a kind of like knocking out of the old pillar of Putin's regime, the promise of stability, that we do not have any major breakthroughs in Russia. However, it doesn't become worse. Now, with all the sanctions and all the consequences of the war, it actually may become worse. And this requires from the Russian ruling class to build another pillars of its rule. Now promising not stability, but some transformation. And there's also a more theoretical argument to this made by the sociologists like Beverly Silver or by another American sociologist, Dylan Riley, that the imperialist rivalry is actually conducive for hegemony. When the imperial powers compete with each other, they need to mobilize the support from the subaltern classes. They are not competing simply militarily. They may start to compete in some positive terms, as actually happened during the Cold War, when there was a competition not simply in the number of the nuclear weapons, but also in the space race, also in science and technology, also in support of the third world countries. And if you're entering into another cycle of the imperial competition, it's quite plausible that we may see the return of hegemony, an organic solution for the hegemony crisis. And another stage that the hegemonizing of the ruling classes may help to build stronger counter-hegemonies from below. And that means that even if the Russian ruling class would now be capable to consolidate its rule in Russia in case they withstand or even win this war, they may sow the seeds over much more dangerous to them, much stronger, much more socially consciousness, much more radical revolutionary threat that than any of our countries have ever seen for decades. The seeds of a new social, let's call it neo-Jacobin revolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments already?
Yeah, thanks honestly for your insights. It was very interesting, especially because the topic is so depressing nowadays with the war. And I like very much your perspective to describe the processes going on, for example, in the transformation after the 1990s in Russia, but also in Ukraine as revolutions, because we often used to see revolutions just as such, if they are kind of successful, whatever that means. And that's not my perspective. I understand your thoughts, like we have to see on the processes of societal transformation, especially also if there's an opposition to capital and state and so on. Yeah, I like this perspective. And I don't know if I have a question or if it's just something I wonder about when you were talking in your first part in the Soviet regime, where you had the idea or the view that there was in fact a communist hegemony, which was that strong that even the left radical opposition was criticizing the regime by being not, however, socialist enough and so on. For me, it's a bit unclear, this question, if it's right. Or in my perspective is that the I would agree to say, okay, there was somehow a communist hegemony, but that was not the hegemony of, for example, the party regime. And so, in fact, the communist statist regime undermines its own hegemony in the spaces by, for example, sending some peasants as kulaken into Gulag and so on. So they worked on undermining the hegemony which was in society in the spaces. I don't know if it's clear. It's not a real question, but maybe I have some doubts on this description that there was in fact a communist hegemony. But or to say it another way, if there was one, I would not stick it to the, for example, the Bolshevist Party so much. But maybe I didn't get you right at this point.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. That's actually very important, and it's a great question, and that's one we. Thinking about right now, and yeah, for many people it's not obvious that the Communist Party had a hegemony in the Soviet society, and the question of terror and massive violence in the 1930s, and not only in the 1930s, is of course one of the important counter-arguments. The thing is that for Gramsci, but also like not simply not relying simply on the authority of Gramsci, but even developing this, the concept of hegemony. Hegemonic rule cannot rely simply on the consent, because it would be simply something, some kind of totally utopian society. In every society, you have coercion, you have violence. You have the conflicts that are resolved by coercion. And hegemony is not simply the lack of coercion, which is not happening in any real-world societies, but it's a combination of coercion with something more. Let's say, coercion against kulaks, but at the same time, mobilization of active consent of the poor peasants. And many people were killed or were sent to Gulag. That's true. At the same time, many people experienced the fundamental transformation of their lives. Moving from the illiterate peasants, who most of them they were in 1920s, to the urban citizens in the post-war society. And they experienced that part of their lives as the they did have consent about this, and which does not deny the importance of violence. It does not deny the all the facts of violence, but it also helps to see that what else happened besides violence, because we can actually have just violence with only passive consent, and this comparison between the Soviet Union before 1960s and post-Soviet societies would point us not only to the scale of terror. We are not experiencing that level of violence right now, hopefully. But at the same time, we lack something. We lack that active, enthusiastic mobilization. We lack this experience of moving forward, of revolutionary change, of the transformation. When in the duration of like years, almost decades, the lives of the masses of citizens are changing in fundamental ways, as it happened in the period of between 1930s till 1960s. What we experience is 30 years of the degradation and collapse, and which ends in the horrible war.
Thank you very much for your talk. I have two questions. One would be about the material interwovenness in the post-Soviet region, because as far as I understand, one of the argumentation lines in Russian state propaganda is that there were bilateral kind of contracts in the post-Soviet, early post-Soviet stage, and that there were certain binding contracts and terms that were very much about, for example, power stations and, I don't know, trains and whatever. And then how far you would say that this and the indebtedness of like the post-Soviet or with the post-Soviet collapse, in how far this redistribution also is forming one of the materialist reasons for the invasion. And the other one is kind of interwoven with my first question, and how far the Ukrainian oligarch or ruling class or oligarchs are connected with Russians' ruling class. So because you talked about the post-Soviet region as somehow as one region, and then dividing into these new nation states with different kind of political developments, but then looking also at what combines them or what connects them, and how far this also plays a role in these Maidan revolutions or the question of power in, for example, the Ukraine. I don't know if my...
Question. Okay, thank you so much. That's so... also very important question and could be actually very illuminating. So the... about the... not sure what you meant by contracts, but the interconnectedness of the post-Soviet economy was, of course, one of the it's a fact, because this was one state and which developed its economy in a centralized way, and when it started to be divided, it had a very painful consequences for the disruption of the economic routes and the trade links and so on. It was a very important part of the post-Soviet crisis. And the some fundamental connections that existed and still are important between the former parts of the formerly unified economy, I believe, is at least part of the reasons why Ukrainian integration into the Western-led institutions, EU, NATO, is actually more dangerous than, let's say, Finnish joining NATO. Although Finland has the border, which is just 150 kilometers far from St. Petersburg, and all that... That which makes all the discussions about how many minutes a rocket needs to fly to Moscow a little bit ridiculous, and why Putin is much calmer, because Finland may join NATO, but makes a war because of Ukraine, very low chances to join NATO. But the economy of Finland cannot be so easily integrated into the Russian political capitalism. And of course, in Ukraine, there are still some valuable for the Russian economy pieces of industry which could be very easily incorporated into formerly unified economy. As it actually happened in these puppet states in Donbass, in Donetsk and Lugansk, in the eastern Ukraine, which in just a matter of years were overtaken by the political capitalist close to the former Ukrainian regime of Viktor Yanukovych, but also to the Russian state. And so that could be a very much likely future for the occupied Ukrainian territories. They're overtaken, at least of those parts of the industry which would remain not destroyed, unlike in Mariupol, into the Russian economy. And that would be much easier than taking over the Western European economy. So that's my idea about this. And about the Ukrainian ruling class and their connections to Russia, genealogically, in their origins, they are the same kind of post-Soviet political capitalists, who also exploited the connections to the old Soviet nomenclatura in order to become very rich in a matter of years. They instrumentalized Ukrainian nationalism in order to legitimate their claim for the part of the collapsing Soviet state, not really believing very much in the Ukrainian national idea, and they had actually a very big problem how to identify Ukraine in a positive way. And the title of a book of Ukrainian second president, Leonid Kuchma, is very illustrative, is very telling. In this respect, he called the book Ukraine is not Russia. Okay, Ukraine is not Russia, but what is Ukraine then? And until this moment, they did have this problem with hegemony crisis. They could not articulate a positive development project that they would be able to lead and that would represent the interest of the whole nations. So these professional middle classes, they did have a kind of like quasi-modernization, ersatz-modernization project that we are joining EU, we are joining proper capitalism, we are joining the civilized world, and so we are going to live at least as good as Poland or Czech Republic. Of course, this would not happen. And they also did have the problem of hegemonizing their interests, and that's what I've just been talking about. But the connections of the Ukrainian ruling class to the Russian ruling class, they exist on the genealogical level, and they could compete in certain economic spheres even now. Although I would not see this war as, I mean, some dogmatic left may present it as like Russian oligarchs fighting against Ukrainian oligarchs. I believe there is a class conflict behind it, but it's a very different class conflict. Ukrainian ruling class was actually divided about the prospects in relation to the transnational capital, which was coming with the anti-corruption agenda, and so a part of Ukrainian ruling class took the clearly a confrontationist position, and they were trying to claim the sovereignty, that all this anti-corruption is simply some kind of like George Soros conspiracy, and so on and so forth. They actually failed. another part of Ukrainian oligarchs, they were trying to take an accommodationist strategy, so that, yes, of course, we are joining the civilized world, but we need to understand that if you start to look into the offshore accounts of Poroshenko or Zelensky, just before the war, there was this Pandora Papers scandal with Zelensky's offshores, which nobody remembers now about and nobody cares now about, because this is the war, and if you start to criticize Zelensky, you are helping Putin. And so if you are capable to sell yourself as some indispensable figure in fight against Putin, the people would just close their eyes on your own corruption. So that's how it is, in very broad strokes.
The next question has been posted in our pad, so I read it out. When you talked about hegemonic crisis, you pointed the limited opportunities for hegemony under demodernizing changes out. Can you explain what you exactly mean with demodernizing in this context? And is modernization then always a condition of hegemony?
Yeah, okay, great question. What is demodernization in the post-Soviet societies? When you have a high added value economy, which was capable to produce space rockets, computers, advanced machines, and which are basically sold for pennies in the 1990s, and are not needed anymore, and the economy is degraded into the extraction and sell of the very low added value goods. In Russian cases, the fundamentals of the economy, gas and oil. In Ukrainian case, it was kind of metallurgy, but also on the quite low level of development. And so instead of the technological advance in economy, you've got the degradation of the economy, demodernization in this case. In political level, you have the politicized society, you have like degrading but still ideological party, which articulate some clear ideologies. As a result, you get the politics dominated by personalistic patronage networks and interests. From more complicated politics, you get more primitive politics. On the level of culture, the number of people who read books, who read press, the number of intelligent press declines. The return of the multiple problems that were actually at least temporarily solved in the Soviet Union, on the level of healthcare, let's say, on the level of basic education, returning back. So these are all the things that I would call demodernization. Gramsci could say about this as history goes back instead of going forward. And that's why I believe that all the discussion about the passive revolution is very misleading. And whether the hegemony is necessarily should be combined with the modernization, good question. I didn't think it through yet, but I would say that that modernization is indeed something very beneficial for the hegemony, because you have more opportunities to connect the interests of the different groups. Who could give an active, rational, participatory consent in the societal change. When the demodernization process happens, there are lesser opportunities to at least partially fulfill the interests of other groups. So whether it's a very strong necessity connection, not sure, but this is definitely, modernization is definitely very conducive to the possibilities for hegemony. And demodernization reduces these opportunities.
I have a question on the relationship of the ruling classes of Russia or the post-Soviet states towards China. And because you said that the American hegemony is shrinking, and that the Russian war, if Russia's victorious, that it might strengthen the position of the ruling classes of Russia. And yeah, that's also the question on how the ruling class is structured in Russia, because I think that the conflict is not just a regional Eastern European conflict, but also a representation of some historic global transformation process, where the world economic power is concentrating more in China, and China is becoming the new center of world market regulations, not just because other countries are tired, but also because of that we are since the 70s in a structural over-accumulation of capital because of modernization and the problem of effective demand for on the one hand and higher productivity and rising output of productive capital, and so I think that this is also, this transformation process is also a representation of the economic laws that that capitalism is going to an end, and I also think that this makes it more that there is a rising necessity of the state to do state intervention and deficit spending or other things. So a transformation, so that there is a transformation process toward some kind of socialist market economy. Maybe, I don't know, but so that's why I'm asking that if Russia is winning the war in the Ukraine, that it may boost this transformation process, and if it is even useful for the, or how it is useful, or in the long run, positive for the ruling class in Russia, if this kind of state intervention and deficit spending may put a negative light or on the legitimation of the ruling classes in Russia, so that the ruling classes, if they are capitalist traditionally, like here in the Western, then state intervention and deficit spending or other kind of policies may shrinken the power or decrease the power of this class and destroy their legitimation, which is why they are against those measures. And so my question is, how are the relationships toward China from the political class and from the leading class in Russia, and what's their position on this global transformation process, if you have ideas on that?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I'm not a Russia-China specialist, not a specialist on the Russia-China relations, but what I would comment in the context of Gramsci is that Russian, let's say, international-oriented ideology right now is very non-hegemonic. So they need to present their war as the war for not just for Russia, but for other nations who are dissatisfied with the U.S. order, or U.S.-led order, or U.S. hegemony. But at the same time, they do not have any positively articulated project for the world. And what they articulate now is the kind of like civilizational ideology. So we are kind of like an ancient Russian civilization, so we have some legitimate claims on the part of the world where Ukraine is allegedly belongs to. And China is also a very ancient civilization, and they also have a sovereign claim on the part of the world, and which should be recognized as equal with other great powers. And there are also Brazil, South Africa, India, and that, of course, raises the question, who is the great power and who is supposed to be kind of like subservient to the great power who would claim a sovereign claim over their lands. But the point is that the whole project is simply demarcation of the territory with references to some kind of like civilizational legitimacy, which is, of course, the claim made to the local elites in the greater states that could join Russia in this project. But this is not exactly a hegemonic project. This is not exactly some project that would articulate the progressive change for the world. So in Russian rhetoric, they identified the ills of the world, how the capitalism is collapsing, how the United States is no more a proper hegemony that doesn't represent the whole world, and so on and so forth. They articulate the crisis of political representation on the global stage, but they cannot offer an alternative hegemony. And so far, it's like this. At the same time, there are discussions that China could be the next hegemon, although in the very Chinese tradition, they have this, they use hegemony in a very negative, pejorative way. Hegemony is something that they fight against. And so for China, it's also, at this moment, it's now a problem how to, if they are going to become the next objectively hegemonic power, objectively the strongest economy, objectively the strongest military, whatever, would they be able to lead other nations? And where exactly they would go? They are going to lead. Socialist market economy. I mean, it's something that would need to be properly articulated in China itself. And who would exactly articulate this? The same Chinese communist nomenclature, Xi Jinping and his successors, or there would be some opposition rising within China that could claim some return to the socialist development on whatever basis. So that's what I would tell on this question.
Thanks very much again, Volodymyr, for your talk, and thank you for participating in the discussion. And we will continue at 9 with another performance.
Okay.